Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, your other co-host is Adam Wybray. Today we're talking about the early 90s TV series Eerie Indiana, and you should also know that these podcasts are transcribed, so there'll be a full transcription in the show notes. Enjoy! Good evening, Adam.
Good evening, Ren.
Hello, it's good to be back.
It is good to be back.
We're still here. We're still making this podcast just about.
Just about scrabbling through lockdown like a pair of daddy long legs with a couple of legs tweaked off by an evil child.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Covered in lint.
Covered in lint, just wafting around the ceiling. So we've been held up by my seeming inability to watch a series of a TV show by myself, but I've managed it eventually. We're here talking about Eerie Indiana, which is an American children's TV series from the early 90s. About a 13-year-old boy called Marshall Teller, who lives in a small town called Eerie, Indiana, which everyone else thinks is a perfectly normal American suburb, but Marshall says it's the center of weirdness for the universe.
Which might be our claim of the week.
Yeah, getting it in early.
Yeah.
Each episode centers around a different example of Eerie's weirdness, with Marshall and his 9-year-old co-investigator, Simon, trying to get to the bottom of something creepy, spooky, or disturbing happening in their town.
My name is Marshall Teller. Not long ago, I was living in New Jersey, just across the river from New York City. It was crowded, polluted, and full of crime. I loved it. But my parents wanted a better life for my sister and me. So we moved to a place so wholesome, so squeaky clean, you could only find it on TV. Unfortunately, nothing could be further from the truth. Sure, my new hometown looks normal enough, but look again. What's wrong with this picture? The American dream come true, right? Wrong. Nobody believes me, but this is the center of weirdness for the entire planet.
Thank you, little paper boy.
Eerie Indiana, my home sweet home. Still don't believe me? You will.
The show was first shown on NBC in the States from 1991 and then on Channel 4 in the UK during 1993, which was before my time. I don't know. Did you watch any of it?
I would have still been into Sesame Street and the like.
Yeah.
It would have gone over my head, to be honest. But my partner, Antonia, did watch it as a kid, and so I thoroughly recommended that I get on and watch it. But I don't think it's been repeated over here since.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Which seems like a bit of a shame, because I feel like the kind of off-kilter sense of humour would still appeal to the zany youth of today with their internet humour. And I think it's held up rather well in terms of production values and, you know, generally the art directions. really good. Like, if you compare, this clearly has more money put into it than, say, Round the Twist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really like Round the Twist, and it's probably genuinely kind of stranger and queasier and just baffling than Eerie Indiana. But it's got some really shonky special effects, whereas Eerie Indiana, there's a little bit of shonk in the video editing. Mm-hmm. But it holds up visually really well. Like, there's some gorgeous art direction, like the matte paintings for some of the sets, just spectacular.
Had you seen any episodes before you watched it for the pod?
Nope, not at all. How about you?
I had seen one episode.
Oh,
my friend Neil recommended. Well, I watched it with him. But that episode was Reality Takes a Holiday, which, well, is definitely one of the better episodes, is not really one to start with, which we'll get into it. But perhaps not the best standalone episode.
No, kind of canonically the last episode, even though technically it wasn't the last episode.
Yeah. But yeah, again, Neil's a few years older than either of us, so he sort of fondly remembered it from watching it on TV. So it's, was it 18 episodes? Yeah.
That sounds right.
Yeah. And
18 or 19, I guess the final episode. Apparently aired for the first time in 1993 when it was syndicated on the Disney Channel. So I guess, there was a bit of a sort of delay in that airing. And then there was a spin-off called Eerie Indiana, The Other Dimension, which I haven't watched any of. It was on the Fox Kids Network, I think is possibly more solidly for kids. And yeah, slightly less interesting, but you know, if somehow we run out of things to cover.
I think, yeah, there's definitely a few like really standout episodes in the series, that are probably the ones that people remember mostly. I mean, I don't know. I say that, then I was just talking to Ava and, she was like, the main thing she seemed to remember was, Dash X with the X drawn on his hand, I think there are definitely some ones that are more standout than others, but
sometimes it leans into being a bit goosebumpsy. Like sometimes it's the plot's not much more than there's some kind of strange creature or apparition and the boys have to investigate it. And then there'll often be a kind of double pullback and reveal, like, oh, actually, it wasn't an alien. It was someone hoaxing an alien. But actually, it was an alien.
There's some of that. And I have to admit that I kind of didn't maybe pay full attention to every episode. And some of them was like, oh, okay, yeah, there's there's an alien, or maybe there's not an alien. Or
I mean,
there's some dogs talking. I kind of get the gist, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm mostly in it for Simon, his little 9-year-old friend, played by Justin Schenkerau, who is just like aggressively adorable. Like, I feel kind of assailed by how cute he is.
Like, he's incredibly delightful.
it's a parkour. He's just joy incarnate. Amazing. Yeah, seriously.
Have you seen a photo of him as an adult? He's still acting and he still has an adorable face.
He's got a sort of YouTube channel going on. He still seems like he's like a good soul. He seems like a nice fella. He's so good as Simon. He really relishes the role. And Simon, the character of Simon, gets to have loads of things happen to him, like lots of sort of identity swaps and, you know, getting really clever for one episode, really boring and geeky for another episode. and so on. And he really, really throws himself into it.
Yeah, the performances from the child actors are generally very good.
Omri Katz as Marshall does a really good sort of bemused kind of expression, like sort of, hey, this is pretty out there, but what do you expect from Eerie kind of face. And I don't know if Jason Marsden as Dash X had to kind of keep up that croaky voice all the way through. But, you know, he's really committed to sounding a bit like a young Tom Waits or something. Film noir protagonist.
Definitely.
There's Jason Marsden, who's got a YouTube channel, actually. And he's a really fun guy. He was also the official voice of Max Goof, Goofy's son. Since 1995.
Wow.
So, Goofy movie, which might also be a selection for
That really freaked me out, Adam.
That early that nightmare scene where he imagines himself going through puberty. Sounds of visceral discomfort.
Genuinely scared me, that movie.
Yeah, same here.
You just took the lid off something there.
Sorry, that's nice. It's been a while since I've done that. That brings me back to the earlier episodes of Still Scared, you know. So it's been a year or two since we've really lifted the lid on something. But yeah, all the child actors are really kind of committed and seem to be having a good time. Like, you really get the sense that this was a very fun show. Like,
yeah. But Simon is the most adorable.
Oh yeah, obviously. I mean, you know, I kind of lose interest when Simon's not on screen. To be honest. Yeah, basically. So did you want to focus particularly on a few representative episodes?
Yeah. I think that makes sense. It's my personal favourites, but also happened to be the first episode, the one from the middle of the series, and then one Reality Takes a Holiday that should have been the last episode, but wasn't. We can go through those and sure, we'll have things to say about other episodes as well.
We'll hoover up bits, but there'll be the crumbs on the carpet, and these will be the big banana splits on the canteen table. Don't know which canteen has a carpet actually, but anyway.
So we start with Foreverwear, which. Is the first episode, is great.
It was directed by Joe Dante of Gremlins 2, The New Batch, and obviously Gremlins as well. But and it definitely has that kind of off-kilter, zany energy that tends to define his films. Mm. Lots of really kind of wild-eyed, over-egged performances and canted angles and wide-angle shots, etc.
Yeah, I was interested in how you describe the technical camera stuff about it, because I'm like, oh, it's definitely doing things. I'm sure Adam will know what they are.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it'd be like the kind of stuff Terry Gilliam does, right? Like, it's all very bug-eyed and kind of hyper real and just super vivid.
Yeah.
Like really, really cheese dreamy, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Foreverwear is a kind of retelling of the Stepford Wives with multi-level marketing. Incidentally, I read the Stepford Wives the first time this year. It's really good. I recommend it. It's a good book.
Oh, great.
So the Teller family have just moved to Erie from New Jersey, and Marshall's mum, Marilyn, who's kind of chill and meant to be a bit disorganized, is pressed into joining the local circle of extremely house proud women, led by Betty Wilson, who wants to sell Marilyn on the forever wear Tupperwares that they're all devoted to, that promise to keep things fresh forever. Then in a kind of gloriously creepy twist, it turns out that it's not just food that the Foreverwear keeps fresh, but also people, as Marshall and Simon discover that Betty Wilson's twins have been stuck in the seventh grade for 30 years and break into the house in the night to unseal them from their plastic preservative Tupperware beds. It's a particularly good image of these human-sized Tupperware at night, kind of filled with dry ice, and Marshall and Simon peeling back the lids. Yeah. Good horror.
Good horror, and yeah, good. I keep coming back to the kind of art direction and just the props in this show. It does use sort of video editing effects and things, but really the standout aspect of the show for me are just these often sort of ginormous props, like the massive Tupperware style containers, for instance.
Yeah.
I'd love to go to a theme park with the objects from this show just everywhere.
They really sell it. You need that kind of popping Tupperware lid kind of effect.
It doesn't just pop, it goes fresh.
Good stuff.
And I like the fact that it's shown to be okay. I think I might be going out on a bit of a limb here, right? But I feel like Erie, Indiana is a pretty deaf positive show. That generally, I would say, the show is generally seen as a bad idea to try to kind of keep things the way they were or keep things kind of unchanging or try to sort of preserve something or... Instead, it's very open to change, and that sometimes that means loss, and sometimes that means change in family or family dynamics. Sometimes that means death and losing someone. It's definitely got, this sort of real theme of kind of, let it go, basically. I'm thinking also of the bank robber ghost in the Hole in the Head gang. For instance, who can't let go of the fact that he's the world's worst bank robber, and so he's and wants to re-rob the bank and can't quite let go of life. And Marshall basically says, lots of people are dead, it's not so bad, you'll have company, come on, it's all right.
I think that's an interesting call. I'm just looking through the other
episodes. Yeah, well, obviously ghost episodes tend towards that. There's also The Dead Letter, the one with Tobey Maguire.
Yes.
So very, very young, sort of fey and theatrical Tobey Maguire. he's hanging around and won't leave until Marshall delivers this this letter from him. Or even say Tornado Days, when you've got the meteorologist who he can't let go of the fact that he led these other people to their deaths, and has just been fixated, sort of Captain Ahab, Moby Dick style, with chasing down this tornado.
Yeah.
I mean, you could even say before we, I mean, we'll get on to discuss it, that even Reality Takes a Holiday is about Marshall not being able to move on with the fact that he's not going to be the star of this show forever.
I think that's a good call. Now, I mean, there is a certain preoccupation with lost things as well.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about the lost hour next, but there's also the episode, I don't know what it's called, episode 4.
The Losers, it's called.
which has this rather Brazil-like Bureau of the Lost with a kind of ducts spewing goo and clanking machinery and bleeping terminals and apothecary shelves and a certified misappropriation engineer who is stimulating the economy by taking people's stuff so they have to replace it.
best defense for burglary in court. I did it to stimulate the economy. So do you think that Foreverwear sets the tone for the series? Because it sounds like you're particularly keen on it, so presumably some of the other episodes didn't quite stand up to it for you.
I did particularly like it, and I mean, I particularly like the creepiness of it, and perhaps there isn't as much creepiness as I might like. I prefer the creepier ones.
I think especially by the time you get to around sort of episode 7, there's this sort of short run which is all about Marshall falling in love with different girls, seemingly. Which is quite irritating and off-putting. And I don't know if they were just trying to, like, turn... Sorry, I forgot his name. Trying to turn Omri Katz into some kind of teen heartthrob. He does have the 90s curtains for it. That is true. And I have to say, there's a lot of pretty fabulous hair in this series. Simon's got his wonderfully sort of bouncy cherubic curls. And then Dash X obviously has his grey hair.
That whole bit I did zone out a bit, to be honest, about the Marshall and his romantic endeavours.
It's like he's 13 going on 14, and you kind of feel like, come on, give it a few years, Marshall. You don't need to be messing around with, it just isn't very interesting, basically. He's interested in all these sort of exciting mysteries, and it's like, oh, but the biggest mystery is the human heart. Yetis and vampires and all of that. That's a bit more... They were exciting,
one
really.
One of the reasons why Simon's so great, because he's he's younger and more, and doesn't really care about these things.
Yeah, that's true. And generally, when you have episodes where Marshall's sort of getting distracted from the mystery, Simon gives him quite a short shrift through it.
I think maybe Foreverwear is like... the best execution of like a creepy concept, but of a kind that comes back throughout the series. There are other sort of weird sort of twisted takes on everyday things, like the one with the man in the bank telling machine.
I quite like that one. He's a sort of over-friendly ATM man. He looks a bit like what do you call him, Max? What's he called? Virtual plastic head, virtual Max. Well, I'll try googling that, but it probably won't work. Plastic head, virtual Max. Come on, Max Street, Max. Max Headroom.
Okay.
It worked.
Max Headroom. Okay.
Do you want to?
Okay.
Yeah, Headroom is one word.
Oh yeah, it does look a bit like that. Yeah. Yeah, okay. cool. who's created by Marshall's dad.
Oh yeah, we should probably mention Marshall's dad is an inventor. Like the father in Gremlins, in fact, you know. But perhaps a bit with a bit more corporate respectability.
And he sort of things he's inventing kind of come up tangentially throughout the series. Do you have any examples?
He invents
hot and cold running smoothies.
Oh,
is something he's working on.
To be fair, I don't think they made that much use of the fact that he's an inventor, all things considered.
No, I mean, you know that he is an inventor, but he also just kind of seems like generic soup dad.
Yeah.
Who's 35.
Oh, don't come with that, please. Come on. Come on, Ren.
Yeah, sorry.
Anyway, I'm...
That's mean.
33. I have two more years. That guy is weird, isn't it? Like, looking at
his
figures. And like, oh, they're an adult. And they're like, oh, I'm an adult. If a child saw me on television, they say, look at that adult. And I still find it a bit weird when I'm walking down the street and, you know, some parent says, oh, you know, mind out of the way of that man, you know, or, you know, or watch out for that man cycling dangerously or, what, you know, whatever, whatever's being said about me. But, yeah, you know, I always have that moment of slight misrecognition. Oh, yeah, yeah, oh, God, yeah, I'm an adult.
Yeah. What were we saying? Yeah, he invents this this automated teller man who then tries to bribe Simon into being friends with him by giving him money. It's quite sad.
Well, I think a lot of the stuff surrounding Simon's quite sad because it's not heavily played upon, but like he's got a really either absent or abusive family or like his parents. So he's always at Marshall's and he's basically adopted into the family.
Yeah.
Like, so there was a line in the Alien one, Marshall's theory of believability, where, you know, Marshall, basically the characters are revealed as a fraud and Marshall's, you know, quite disillusioned. And his sort of dad says, look, there's only one thing you can really rely on. And that's that, you know, your parents love you. And Simon, like, gets out a tissue and is crying. And I think it's meant to be like, oh, he's, you know, oh, that's so sentimental and tough. But, like, you know, if you see Simon as someone who's, you know, basically isn't loved by his parents, I was like, oh, that's really awful. I just found it really heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And also, you know, Simon's the best. Why would...
Well, yeah.
You know, what awful parents to reject Simon.
Yeah.
It is a little bit of a theme, I would say, in the show, sort of neglectful parents.
Yeah, because we have Sarah Bob.
Is she the one with the special pencil, like sort of penny crayon?
Yeah, the penny crayon girl. Yeah. She names herself Sarah Sue at the end, but she lives with her horrible dad and her horrible brothers who like make her do everything for them.
Yeah, it's a bit of a kind of Cinderella story.
Yeah.
And you know, and they're really, I mean, you know, they're very broadly drawn, but yeah, they're shown to be, you know, incredibly crass and just really mean and bullying and unpleasant. And then there's the episode, which I think is officially the last episode, The Broken Record, with Pod, the kind of nerdy friend.
God, that one's sad.
Yeah, yeah, with this really verbally, you know, abusive, bullying father who kind of gets into punk rock. So, yeah, it is. One thing I like about the show, I guess, is that for all its zaniness, it is quite oddly melancholy. I don't know if that's because of the kind of theme of loss and sort of people who have gone missing or are absent. But yeah, I do think it has an interesting tone.
I kind of, I don't know, when you said melancholy, it made me think of the world of Stuff. which is quite a central location in the show, which is this... it's a weird shop that's also a kind of diner.
Yeah, like milkshake bar.
Yeah. And just sells all kinds of just tat and nonsense. But they're there quite a lot. It turns up in lots of the episodes. And it's kind of this sort of quite... big old kind of barn-like building with all these really high shelves and sort of dusty objects on them, and I don't know, it has a very particular atmosphere, I think.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. I think it's part of the show. It's very much set in kind of small town America, and it does feel, I mean, it's not Indiana, so it's not like the Rust Belt, but like it feels like, you know, it's corn country, right? And it does feel like an area that's slightly obsolete almost. You know, there's a surprising amount of stuff in the background about finances, right? And the town not having very much money. Like this crops up quite a lot, and they have this sort of greedy mayor who's always, you know, seizing on things to try to bring more money into the town.
The town always does feel like it's like slightly in crisis.
Like it's, you know, it could end up becoming like a ghost town, basically, you know, that there's always, it feels, exactly, like things are almost on the edge of shutting down.
Which is probably a good point to introduce the Lost Hour. Is an episode I really enjoyed. But we learn at the top of the episode that there's no daylight savings time in Indiana because the farmers say the cows would get confused. Marshall's dad tells that to Marshall and Simon, and Marshall's incredibly indignant that he doesn't get his extra hour and decides he's going to set his watch back an hour anyway. When he does this, when he wakes up, everyone else has disappeared. And he goes onto the street and there's, you know, sinister garbage collectors and mirror shades and jackboots who are sort of walking menacingly towards him. But he's rescued by an elderly milkman who tells him that he's ended up in the Lost Hour.
It's a real Twilight Zone for kids episode.
Absolutely, yeah. And the milkman explains that the garbage collectors are there to clear up things or people that are messing up the space-time continuum, and Marshall is now one of them, one of the things that's messing up. Marshall looks in the back of the milk truck and sort of sees through the window his family and Simon at breakfast without him. But instead of the missing girl who was on the milk carton the other day, it's himself on there. So he figures out that he needs to find the girl who was on the milk carton and heads to the world of Stuff. And even more desolate than usual, but there is Janet, who is honestly a style icon. I loved what she was
wearing. Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's this kind of military jacket covered in like badges and medals and like a compass and like tassels. It's great. She's not very pleased to see him, and kind of has resigned herself that like she just thinks that everyone else has like disappeared somewhere and like she's like on her own. But eventually he persuades her to look in the back of the milk truck, where she sees her family who are devastated at losing her. The milkman tells Marshall and Janet that they need to get back before the hour is up or they'll be lost for another year. And Marshall manages to communicate to Simon through his image on the milk carton and tell him that he needs to fix Marshall's watch, which Simon manages to do, and both Marshall and Janet are reunited with the main timeline. Not before the elderly milkman drops the bombshell that he's Marshall's far future self.
Oh, yeah.
For some reason. What did you think of this episode?
Oh, I really like this one. Like, it's really neatly constructed. Like, there are some episodes where it feels like the show spins its wheels a bit, whereas this one is, twist and turn after twist and turn. And it's one that would have really scared me as a kid. You know, anything, I guess, with weird ontology, right? Like things like something metaphorical being literal, used to really freak me out as a kid.
Accidentally slipping into another reality, meaning to,
those kind of fears were really real to me when I was little. I think I would have found that episode really creepy. It actually reminds me of an Alan Ohlberg story that I read when I was young and made quite a big impression on me, about an elderly woman. It's meant to have quite a nice, I think it's meant to be a kind of bittersweet, melancholy, but quite nice story that kind of scared me as a kid, about this old woman who has squirreled away, you know, saved a few hours for herself through the years. So when she's on her deathbed, she's able to then go back to, you know, being 8 years old and use the 2 hours she saved then, and then, you know, goes forward to when she was in her and so on. I don't know, that idea of time being displaced, right? Like the lost hour, the kind of time out of time.
It's a little bit like the girl in the painting in The Witches as well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The start of the Darkest Rising books. Just remember the character going downstairs and like their house sort of being frozen, basically. I can't remember if all the people, if their family are frozen too. And then when they leave the house, they're in this sort of medieval realm. But it's that kind of in-between moment that's scary, where they're sort of not quite in one time, not quite in another.
Yeah. I think that definitely hits on a potent childhood fear.
The episode directed by the wonderfully named Bob Balaban. Bob Balaban. Yeah.
Great.
What great name. I like the fact that you've chosen episodes with different directors. So, you know, the first one was Joe Dante. You haven't chosen any episodes directed by Sam Pillsbury, who directed The ATM with the Heart of Gold, and who also directed Free Willy 3, The Rescue, Knight Rider 2010, and Zanderly. You remember when we used to do the Nicolas Cage blog?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so Zandali is that film where Nick plays the artist and he has this mental breakdown near the end and goes, black it all out, and like covers himself with black paint.
Okay. yeah, I don't remember that.
Okay, yeah, you might have repressed it.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly a pedigree. Yeah, and I think it's probably somewhere between I think it's after The Lost Hour, but before, well, obviously before Reality Takes a Holiday, that we meet the kind of third main character, Dash X, who is a strange grey-haired, raspy-voiced kid who's kind of set up as Marshall's antagonist kind of towards the end of the series. Yeah, it's like a curious character.
Yeah, and it feels like you get a sense that these mysteries about him are being set up, like, you know, is he an alien? You know, where does he come from? And they're never properly resolved, which I quite like, that he remains enigmatic kind of right to the end of the show.
Yeah.
and I don't know, he's an oddly charming character. He's very charismatic. But yeah, he's also, you know, really out for himself. But then, you know, he's kind of got amnesia and he's all alone in the world. He's just a kid. So, you know, like I was kind of complaining a bit about Dash X, Antonio, and like, oh, like, he's so mercenary. And Antonio's like, well, yeah, but, you know, he has to be. which is a fair point. You know, he's living in like an abandoned building and having to steal food and go dumpster diving to eat. So, you know, it makes sense that he's sometimes got to put his own interests first.
He turns up in the episode with the ghosts in the mill and
then he just sort of hangs around and, yeah, sometimes comes up with schemes to make money.
Yeah.
So in The Loyal Order of Corn, for instance, he somehow, even though, you know, he must only be 14 or whatever, gets this job at the club so he can kind of find answers about his past. So, yeah, he's always sort of wheeling and dealing. Yeah, the Loyal Order of Corn's a fun episode.
Yeah. It's a particularly cheese-dreamy one. Yes, the Marshall's dad joins the corn masons, where they wear corn hats and call each other Brother Husker, and
and sing a song.
And sing a song.
are we gonna sing it together?
Oh, okay.
Okay.
It'd be horrible.
No, it'll be beautiful. We just need to, like, you know, add some, you know, vocalizer or whatever.
Oh, okay, right. Right.
Okay. Hail to thee, O peers of splendor, joyously we pledge our job. We declare our staunch allegiance to protect your kingly corp.
That's enough of that.
Yeah, we don't want to hemorrhage, listeners. Not that many, you know.
We can't afford to lose more than a stanza of singing, I don't think.
Okay, yeah. since we're singing, before we forget, we could go on to our text of the week.
Yeah, I think we should.
It's a bit silent. Oh, good. Texture.
The week.
Yeah, I was hoping that this. Oh, I thought that this sort of plaster hand I've got could be used as an instrument, but apparently not, sadly.
Alas.
Back it goes. It's a nice ornament.
Yeah.
It's got little smiley faces on the fingertips.
Good. do you want to go first?
Yeah, all right. So my texture of the week is from an episode I didn't actually like very much, but I did like the texture, which is Mr. Chaney, which is a werewolf-based episode. Marshall is chosen as the Harvest King, and he must go and face a werewolf in the forest. And the texture of Mr. Chaney's face when he transforms into a werewolf is astonishing. Like, it's a really rubbery latex mask. And they kind of do the transition through a kind of weird video editing effect.
Yeah.
And so his face morphs awfully into this latex mask. And like I kept trying to sort of pause it on the morphing. And it just looked like this sort of bubbling, hairy mass. Like, it's just really, like a really weird texture because it both looked really fake and digital and really kind of material and hairy and oozy. Not a good episode really, but a great texture.
Cool. My texture is Marshall's whole Museum of Horror. He usually puts an item related to the goings on of the episode at the end, so it includes such textural items as a petrified bologna sandwich, a Polaroid of a UFO, a retainer that gives the owner the ability to hear dog's thoughts, a white gloved hand from a robot ATM mascot, and a pair of zombie glasses deemed the ultimate tool of mental fascism. Yeah.
Yeah. That's episode 16, Loyal Order of Corn. There's another financially based episode next with zombies in PJs, which the town are tricked into buying objects on credit.
Oh, yep. So
thus damning themselves to hell in the process.
Yep.
And then the next episode, which should be the last episode, is Reality Takes a Holiday, directed by Ken Kwapis.
Yeah. This is a spectacularly fourth wall breaking episode, in which the rest of Marshall's family and Simon go to the cinema, and Marshall stays behind. But when he goes to the mailbox, he finds the script for the episode he's currently in. He goes back into the house, but it's turned into a film set. Everyone's calling him Omri, and no one he knows is acting like themselves. He goes to the world of stuff and finds Radford, who's the owner, who's the only person who's not acting meta. But then Radford brings out a script, and Marshall realizes that if there's a script, there must be a writer somewhere. He bursts into the writer's office to find Dash X in there, who's busy trying to make himself the main character and kill off Marshall. Marshall manages to trick the script writer into leaving the set and sneaks into the office and rewrites the script so he doesn't get unceremoniously shot by Dash X. He goes down to the family breakfast table set and sort of tries to delay the filming by asking about his character's motivation, in which they say, your motivation is you say a few lines, you go outside, you get shot and you die. But the rewrites come just in time. They get the new scripts and Marshall says action, and the world morphs back into his reality. But yeah, it's a very cool concept and a fun episode, which has all these kind of alternate reality sort of tropes of these kind of characters we've come to know suddenly acting opposite to what we expect.
Yeah, and it feels like, you know, the actors are kind of sending themselves up as well, which is a lot of fun. So Justin Schenkerel, playing himself now, rather than Siren, you know, is just absolutely brash and awful, and just playing himself as like the most sort of entitled child actor that ever lived, which is really fun. I think it really does manage to get across that kind of panic of a nightmare and things unraveling, the kind of ground slipping away from beneath your feet. Well, also, yeah, just being a really neat ending to a series. I mean, I kind of wish almost that we had got a second season about Dash X. You know, I really like the idea that, you know, with Marshall being written out, so, you know, the show kind of gets written out of existence as well.
Yeah, I don't know if I have all that much more to say about it, but it's just a really good episode.
Yeah, I mean, it is probably not the right one to watch first.
No,
but, you know, if you are interested in dipping into Eerie Indiana, I think those episodes you've chosen are good ones. You know, I'm quite fond of the ATM with the Heart of Gold. No Brain, No Pain, which is the one with the apparently homeless man who's actually a genius who's had his brain kind of stolen, has a really nice kind of feels. It feels very much like the kind of French cinema du look, like kind of Luc Besson film or something. It's got a kind of Fifth Element-y vibe to it.
I think the I helpfully didn't write down any of the episode names. Episode 6, the one with the one with the optometrist and the no fun glasses.
Just Say No Fun.
Just Say No Fun. Deserves an honourable mention, if only for the brilliant kind of, I don't know, the montage when they go to the optometrist and is kind of,
oh yeah,
it's all, everything's kind of spinning and
when they have that kind of surrealist freakout montage, and Schenkerow's really great, you know, playing this really boring version of Simon. I kind of hope that if Schenkerow, if you're listening to this, you know, let it be known that you were the best darn thing about Eerie Indiana.
He's so good.
So any other kind of thoughts about the show? Like, how do you think it compares to other kind of shows of its ilk? Let's say we set it against Round the Twist.
Yeah, I mean, I think it they're definitely related. I think Eerie Indiana is kind of more contained and less wacky and scatological.
Well, yeah, that's certainly true.
I think it does have this sort of, I was saying, this kind of slightly melancholy, subdued, sort of dusty feeling to it. Just kind of being in this sort of forgotten place. So I think it's quite, its tone is quite distinct, I think.
Yeah. Oh, and it's probably also worth mentioning, finally, that there's a whole bunch of Eerie Indiana spin-off books.
Oh.
Like, quite a lot. Looking on Wikipedia, there's 17 of them, in fact.
Oh, wow, okay.
So, yeah, you know, I think these are characters in the kind of world that we have a lot of fun with. You know, it'd be a very easy show to write fan fiction about.
I don't know if it was a great show for me to just like binge watch, because I think it's a kind of show, it has a lot of great moments and sort of weird sort of memorable ideas, but not all of the episodes are particularly exciting.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I wouldn't, you know, I've also been watching during lockdown The Simpsons from its start to heaven knows where. I mean, into season 9, so I'm now having to kind of, Antonio and I having to cover, you know, how much further we're going to go.
Yeah,
And yeah, you know, The Simpsons at its best, say, you know, seasons, I don't know, 3 through 6, you know, are just relentlessly good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just sort of stunning episode after stunning episode. And yeah, Eerie Indiana is not quite a classic in that sense, but it's a really likable show, and yeah, it definitely deserves to be remembered.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, it's pretty kind of charming.
Yeah,
and I think does have quite a few sort of sticky ideas. You know, I can definitely imagine if you watched it when you were a kid, and you'd be like, oh yeah, remember that?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I think I'd definitely recommend sort of dipping into a few episodes.
Although I will add that my DVD box set was completely terrible. Like,
yeah,
like the episode listings are like wrong. So one DVD has like, it has the same episodes as the previous DVD, but one different, for instance, like, yeah. So I did get to watch all the episodes, but yeah, they do not match up to what's on each of the individual slipcases. So yeah.
Oh, that is the other thing about it. It isn't really on any streaming services, at least in the UK. I don't think so. We both bought the DVD box set. Yeah. So, might be a little hard to get a hold of just to dip into a few episodes.
If you're an American or even Canadian listener, for instance, you might find it easier.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, should we wrap it up?
Yeah, I think so. Oh, I've just found a few bonus textures at the bottom of my notes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Kid stroking the bristles of a giant toothbrush. This was in the No Fun Glasses episode. a crow wearing a nappy. No idea where that was. But
I can't even remember that.
It happened. And, oh, Cindy's Tornado Day costume.
Oh, okay, yeah. That's a good choice for a texture.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, a lot of good costumes. A lot of 90s fashion as well in this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Thanks for listening. Sorry it's been so long.
Yeah.
Hey. Did an episode, but hey-ho. Or maybe not watch a series with quite so many episodes next time.
Yeah.
Expediency we'll sakes.
Yeah.
Our intro music is by Maki Yamazaki. Our outro music is by Joe Kelly. Our artwork's by Letty Wilson. You can find details of their stuff in the show notes. You can find us on Twitter at StillScaredPod or email us at StillScaredPodcast@gmail.com. Do you have a sign off for us, Adam?
Yeah, I was going to keep it simple and say, keep it eerie, creepy kids.
Yeah, keep it eerie.
Bye.
See you next time. Bye.
Cool.